Yes, good evening, and I'm very happy to be here tonight. I know that it's always dangerous for someone to speak after dinner was served, but dessert will be coming, so there will be something to wait for at the end. The topic for tonight is discussing certain reflections on the separation of church and state, and I want to do so wearing two hats. I want to do so, first of all, from various halachic standpoints, and also just to appraise you, I'm sure many of you are familiar with these developments, with some of the developments on the legal fronts, and what the Jewish community is doing about them, and what the Jewish community should be doing about them. And I really have four different points I want to address, and time will not allow me to elaborate too much, and I'll certainly be willing to take questions on any point that someone wants further elaboration on. Question number one is, as a Torah observant community, as Jews who adhere to the Torah, as Jews that call ourselves Orthodox, should we actively push for a social agenda that more closely mirrors Torah values? As you know, basically, Clinton and the Democratic administration is pushing a whole variety of initiatives that to some extent run against what we as Orthodox Jews believe in, issues such as gay rights, issues such as abortion and the like. And the question is, what should our stance be? Should our stance be in favor of greater freedom, wherever that freedom leads? Or should our stance be to try to contribute towards the realization of a society that mirrors Torah values? Well, the primary text that one would examine to get a Jewish perspective on this matter would be a well-known passage in Maimonides' Code, in the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, in the Laws of Malachim, the Laws of Kings, where the Rambam talks about the seven commandments of Noach. We know that Jews have to keep 613 mitzvahs of the Torah. The Goyim have somewhat of an easier way. They only have to keep seven, although in fact, some of those seven include many, many of the mitzvahs that we have, such as not murdering, not stealing, not cutting off the limb from an animal that's alive, which is really a reflection of a cruelty to animals issue. And there are various sexual offenses under Noahide law, and we call this Noahide law. And Noahide law, to some degree, is even stricter than Jewish law as it applies to Jews. Abortion is a very good example. The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that if a Jew kills a fetus, aborts a fetus, it is normally forbidden, but it is not a capital offense. In other words, it is not murder within the definition of capital punishment. And yet, the Gemara tells us, B'nai Noach ne'ergu al ha'ubrin, that if a ben Noach, if a non-Jew, were to abort a fetus, there would be a chi of misa, there would be a capital crime. It would be murder for which he could be executed. So abortion is an example. Now, gay rights, homosexuality is also prohibited, not only under Jewish law, but it's also prohibited under Noahide law. The Gemara has a drasha, the Gemara has an interpretation of the verse, the davak biishto, that God said, man, and that means all men, Jews or non-Jews, shall cleave unto their wives, velo bezachor, and not with another man. So homosexuality is also something that is proscribed under Noahide law. So in many of these social issues, what we're dealing with is not an attempt to impose Jewish law on non-Jewish society. That would be ludicrous. The Torah itself does not require that non-Jews obey Jewish law. But rather, the issue that we're facing here is the issue of the desirability or even the obligation to impose Noahide law on Noahides, on non-Jewish people. By the way, you may have read a few, it was around 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, there is a resurgence of what is called the Noahide movements among people who were formerly Christians. It's actually a very interesting development. Around 100 years ago, there was a Catholic priest in France who wanted to convert to Judaism. And he approached a rabbi in Italy, and the rabbi in Italy said, if you want to do God's will, you don't have to become Jewish. God has a plan for non-Jews as well, and it is the seven commandments of Noah, believing in God and keeping the seven commandments and the like. And this priest actually wrote a whole book. He became converted to the Noahide religion. And the way he describes it is a very interesting way of looking at it. It's that essentially there is one world religion. That world religion is Noahidism. The Jews are the priests. The Jews are the Kohanim of that world religion. It's not that we have a Jewish religion and we have other religions. Just as within Judaism we have Kohanim, So within the religion of Noachidism, the Jews are Kohanim. And indeed, the Torah describes the Jewish people as Mamleches Kohanim, as a kingdom of priests. So in either event, since around 100 years ago, there has been isolated pockets of Noachite non-Jews, and it's been growing. I have a friend who lives near Atlanta, and on Shabbos he has a shul, and on Sunday he is the Jewish minister of a Noachite congregation. These are non-Jews, formerly Christian people, but not now, and now they observe the seven commandments of Noach. And indeed, if one is a Noachite, one has to have a rabbi to whom one directs shilas regarding Noachite law. Ideally, those rabbis should be non-Jewish rabbis. So perhaps we will see in the near future the development of Noachite yeshivas. As it is right now, basically you have to go to a local rabbi that is well-versed in Noachite law. Rabbi Weinberg, the Rosh Yeshiva of Ne'er Yisrael, has a number of non-Jews with whom he has frequent contact in terms of resolving various fine points of Noachide law. So the question is, what is our role, what is our obligation to push, not the Jewish agenda, so to speak, but the Noachide values that Jewish law identifies? Now the Rambam says very clearly in the Laws of Kings, when it's Yad Yisrael Takifa, when there is a Jewish state, a Jewish state that is governed by the laws of the Torah, there is a responsibility on the state to ensure not only that Jews obey the Torah, but that Noachide law is kept as well. Now, in terms of setting up court systems and in advancing this agenda, etc. So many have argued that by analogy, based on Rambam's view, that there is an affirmative obligation on a Jewish society to seek to advance the values that the Torah mandates for B'nai Noach, that we would have to actively work towards an agenda that mirrors Noachide law. So for example, this position would say we would have to take an anti- or a pro-life stance, anti-choice, however you want to call it. We would have to be against gay rights agendas and the like. I would suggest, however, that at best, the matter is equivocal. The matter is very, very doubtful. Let's take, for example, the issue of abortion. In the past election in Maryland, we had a question on the ballot whether the rights of choice should be broader or more restrictive. And how should a Jew vote? This is a practical question. People would ask a rabbi occasionally, how should I vote in the ballot box? Am I mechuyev? Does the Torah obligate me to vote to restrict abortion rights? And the question is, it's really ambiguous. Because the notion of protesting activities in society that are against what we believe in can be a double-edged sword. And that is, one can make the argument that the Rambam's ruling is fully applicable in a society which is governed by Torah, in a society where Jews are the majority, in a society where Torah observance is the majority. However, one can argue that in a society where Jews are a minority and where Orthodox Jews are a minority of a minority, the notion of working actively to push a certain religious agenda can be counterproductive to our interests. In other words, our argument might be that our position should be in favor of maximizing the freedom of individuals to make choices. Because by maximizing the freedom of individuals to make choices, we are ensuring a society in which our freedom of choice, which means for us the freedom to follow our religious dictates of conscience, is not going to be compromised. Because once we work within the framework of a society that restricts rights to choice, that could certainly work against us as well as working for us. And one of the considerations we have to be aware of is whether we are winning short-term battles, which can ultimately turn into long-term defeats. In war, in terms of backlashes, in terms of Christian majority fundamentalism turning around and imposing various restrictions on us, you never know. So one can certainly take an argument, and again, I'm not going to be machria, decide this point, but one can certainly say that the Rambam's halacha of positively and affirmatively advancing and imposing Noachide law makes sense, indeed, only in the context in which the Rambam advances it, and that is the context of a Jewish society, a Jewish state that is committed to Torah values and has the means to enforce those Torah values. And at that point, there's a responsibility for ensuring that Noachide values are met as well. Even, for example, something like gay rights. Well, again, it's obviously a very controversial and a very highly divisive topic, and I'm not going to address the particular logistical problems of homosexuals in the military. That's a totally other problem. But even there, well, let's assume that a jurisdiction is trying to consider a law which would prohibit employment discrimination against homosexuals. Well, keep in mind that even the Torah does not say that gay people aren't entitled to have a job. The Torah says it's prohibited, but the Torah says eating treif is prohibited too. Not keeping Shabbos is prohibited. Are we in favor of a law that says if you don't keep Shabbos, you lose your job? If you eat treif, you lose your job. And if we start having various laws that advance religious agendas, could that be turned against us later? So one could certainly say, and going back to abortion as well, that even if one is absolutely opposed to homosexuality, as of course I am and every religious Jew must be, and even if we are opposed to abortion, as we must be, except in narrowly defined circumstances, such as risk to the mother's life, and that includes a psychological dimension as well, but one can be opposed to abortion, and one can still take a political stance of pro-choice. Not because of the rhetoric that it's a woman's body and she can do whatever she wants, because we reject that. First of all, a person's body is not their own, it's God's. But because we believe that certain matters are not properly within the realm of a secular political state to enforce, and that as long as we live in Golos, and as long as we don't have a Melech and a Beis HaMikdash and Mashiach, religious matters should not be matters which are matters of coercion, that we should not use the secular state to enforce religious agendas, but rather we should use the tools of teaching, the tools of ethics, the tools of instruction, the tools of raising morality to bring people to the ways of Torah. In fact, if I could digress, part of the tremendous polarization between the religious and the non-religious in Israel, which is a lot worse than it is in the United States, is precisely because the religious have gotten involved in politics. And at that point, whenever some decision has to be made to advance religion, it's no longer you based on the rhetoric of morality and the rhetoric of bringing people closer to Hashem, but it becomes a matter of political deal-making. And as a result, I believe that the Torah and Hashem are really dragged through the mud. And there's a tremendous chilul Hashem. And if you talk to chilonim, the non-religious in Israel, they will say very, very pointedly, again, perhaps they have vested an interest in making an excuse, but they will say that it is the involvement of the religious groups in politics that has destroyed for them, and for many of them, the attractiveness of religion. So ironically, in the United States, the notion of separation of church and state is to some degree, and there are some drawbacks which I'll get to, but to some degree is a very positive development, because it ensures that the tools of religion will be tools of morality and spiritual elevation, and it also ensures that the cudgel of state intervention, federal or state intervention, cannot be used against Jewish interests, precisely because we can't use the state to advance Jewish interests. He who lives by the sword dies by the sword. We use the law to infringe the freedoms of some, then that could result in using a law to infringe the freedoms of Jewish people as well. So one has to think very carefully and cautiously before one simply invokes the Rambam's ruling that we have an obligation to enforce Noahide law. I would also go further, and that is, let's take the abortion situation. Ultimately, the Rambam is dealing with a problem of trying to minimize violations of Noahide law, that we have an obligation to minimize violations of Noahide law. Well, the question we have to ask ourselves is, empirically, would a stricter anti-abortion statute reduce the number of abortions, in which case it would be accomplishing the Rambam's goal, or will it result in greater out-of-state or back-alley abortions or the like? That's yet another calculation. Are you, in fact, advancing the Noahide goal by having to have some type of legislative infringement where people will then do it on their own anyway? That's an empirical question that has to be addressed. So these are extraordinarily problematical areas. One cannot be simplistic. Of course, we are against an unrestricted right of abortion as a matter of Jewish law. Of course, homosexuality is not proper according to Jewish law. But whether that should translate into being what is called a pro-lifer, or whether that should translate in being against gay rights ordinances is a totally different question. One can argue that we should generally try to be on the side of non-interference rather than in the side of interference. Again, I don't resolve this question. I just throw it out for your consideration. Let me digress, though, on interesting points. If you remember, during the campaign, and this happens really during every election, there's a lot of personal dirt that is unearthed about various candidates. And one related question, apart from the social agenda, is do personal failings, such as even adultery, let us say, disqualify a person from a Torah perspective from serving in political office? In other words, are they relevant as to assessing a candidate's suitability for office? Once again, there is kind of a religious notion here. After all, a president should be someone who is a role model, a source of inspiration, and yet should this be an automatic disqualification? And there's an interesting discussion in the Sefer HaIkarim, which is a very, very prominent and famous work in Jewish philosophy that was written in the 1400s by Rav Yosef Alba, where he raises a famous question. There are a lot of answers to the question. And we find that Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, who was the first king of Israel, when he was commanded to destroy Amalek, we're going to read about it in this Shabbos of Haftorah, he didn't kill the king of Amalek. So because of this, Shmuel told him, because you did not obey the word of Hashem, you will no longer be king. You have forfeited the monarchy. Shaul did one chet, and he was out of the picture. We find with King David, who did the very great sin of Bathsheba. Again, the Gemara says it wasn't quite as bad as it sounds. Uriah had given Bathsheba a get, but clearly it is described as David committing something which is like adultery, even if it's not exactly adultery, and sending Uriah to the front to meet his death is like murder, although it's not exactly murder, but it's condemned in those strong terms. And yet, David survives. Not only that, but the son that he has from Bathsheba becomes Shlomo HaMelech, and the whole line of royal succession comes from David and Bathsheba. So why is it that Shaul makes one mistake and he's out? And David does something that seems to be worse. Shaul's sin was a sin of omission. David was a sin of commission. Why is David given such favorable treatment? So there are a lot of answers. One answer is, in terms of how they respond to their situation, Shaul, when Shmuel tells Shaul, why didn't you do the job? Shaul, you'll notice in the Psukim, keeps on offering different excuses. First he says, well, I did everything. And Shmuel says, well, I hear the sheep, and I hear the king. And then Shaul says, well, it's not my fault, I listened to them. There are three or four times that Shaul offers excuses. He doesn't acknowledge his responsibility. David, when Nathan HaNavi gives David the famous parable about the poor man who only had one sheep, David says one word, Chatasi, I have sinned. No excuse, no explanation, total acknowledgement. That's one aspect. But the Sefer HaIkarim, relevant to this topic, says a different point. The Sefer HaIkarim says that Shaul's failure was political. He was given a job as monarch to eradicate Amalek. He failed in the execution of his responsibility as king. That disqualifies you from office. You have failed to carry out your royal responsibilities. David's failures were personal human failures. And the Sefer HaIkarim says that human failures do not disqualify someone from political office. It is only the professional misfeasance that does. So you have a striking parallel. Clinton could have quoted Rav Yosef Alba during the campaign. He didn't need to, as it turned out. But it is a very interesting analogy that really shows you can find all sorts of things in the Torah that are even relevant to the nitty-gritty issues of the political campaign. Now, a second issue I want to discuss is more on the legal side, and those of you who are lawyers perhaps are very much involved in this, and that is the attempts in Congress and within the Jewish community to pass a law that is called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. This is an extremely important law, and let me give you the backgrounds to this situation. Traditionally, for really many, many years, we know that the Constitution says Congress shall pass no law which infringes on the free exercise of religion. This is one of our most cherished constitutional protections, that we have the right to freely practice our religion. Now the question becomes, There are a lot of things that are, of course, Congress can't say you can't practice your Judaism, right? That would be against the Constitution. And although the Constitution says only Congress, but it's been well established for over 100 years, that the 14th Amendment, which says no state shall deprive people of due process of life, liberty, and property without due process of law, effectively incorporates freedom of religion on the state and local level as well. So that's very well established. Now, the problem we have is this. There are many, many laws which are not targeted against religious groups, which prohibit general practices, which may infringe on religious liberty. For example, the earliest case in the Supreme Court was the case involving polygamy. Mormons, as you know, believe in polygamy. Polygamy is prohibited by the laws of all jurisdictions. So a number of Mormons brought a case which eventually reached the United States Supreme Court that for a state to prohibit polygamy was a violation of their free exercise of religion. And the court rejected that argument, etc. Now, the standard generally was for many years that if a general state law infringes on religious observance, a religious accommodation must be granted unless the state could show what is called a compelling state interest, unless there was some overriding and essential reason not to grant the accommodation. The accommodation had to be granted. This had been the standard since a case, Sherbert versus Verner, some other cases as well. This is called the compelling state interest test that basically says, unless the state can show a real important reason, whatever that means exactly, why they will not give you an out, they have to give you an out to follow your religious convictions. Well, this was the law until 1990. In 1990, a case came up in front of the Supreme Court. This was the famous Peyote case. It's infamous or famous, depending on your orientation. This involved two people in Oregon who were members of the Native American religion that smokes these mushrooms, these psychedelic mushrooms, as part of their religious ceremonies. They lost their job. They were fired. They were actually drug counselors. they lost their job. They were denied employment compensation. They were denied employment benefits, unemployment, because they were fired for criminal misconduct. And then they argued, what do you mean criminal misconduct? We couldn't be prosecuted for this because we have a free exercise right to practice our religion. So we haven't done anything criminal. We have a constitutional right to practice our religion. Therefore, it's not criminal misconduct. Therefore, we can't be denied employment compensation. It's interesting. The case was not involving an actual criminal prosecution. The case involved a denial of unemployment, but the subsidiary issue was whether, or the ultimate issue was whether this was proscribable criminal misconduct. Well, the Jewish organizations were not too worried about Smith because they essentially said, well, we can let these guys lose their benefits without changing the standard. After all, even if we say that you must have a religious exemption unless there's a compelling state interest, so we could say, a court could have said very easily that the fight against drugs, the need to get drugs out of society, is such an overriding importance that it is a compelling state interest. So Smith posed no particular problem because everybody figured these guys would lose their case, but they would lose their case on a compelling state interest theory. And that's not going to endanger Jewish observance because, by and large, the mitzvah, no, we don't have to take psychedelic drugs. We get high on life, as they say. So it really didn't bother us. And that's why many of the Jewish organizations didn't even bother that much with the Smith case, because who cares if a bunch of, you know, druggies get convicted or don't get convicted or don't have their unemployment benefits. But there was a bombshell, because Justice Scalia for the Supreme Court said the following. He said, you know, we don't need this compelling state interest rhetoric. Rather, he says, as long as the law is non-discriminatory, as long as the law does not specifically single out religion, as long as it doesn't say, for example, Native Americans cannot smoke mushrooms for religious ceremonies, as long as it's general, he says, that's it. Your free exercise rights protect what you think, but they don't protect what you do. And as long as the statute is general and non-discriminatory, there is no longer any constitutional right to a religious exemption. Now, at least in theory, this is a holding of the court that can have tremendous, tremendous repercussions for the cause of religious freedom. And there are some cases where this already occurred. I'll just mention a few. Theoretically, well, let's take cruelty to animals. Let's assume that we have a statute that talks about not causing cruelty to animals and would ban slaughter of animals. Now, clearly, if the statute were to say, can't shech, that would be discriminatory against religion. But what if it's phrased in general terms? Cruelty to animals means animals can only be killed by stunning, or animals can only be killed by 50,000 watts electrocution. For many years, it was thought that such a law would be unconstitutional as applied to shechita because of the need for a religious accommodation. But under Scalia's rhetoric, as long as you're dealing with a general anti-animal cruelty statute, shechita is not entitled to any type of constitutional protection. Indeed, there are inspectors in Iowa and some of the other states that are already making noise that shechita should be prohibited. Again, these are isolated inspectors, but who knows where it'll go, because it's a violation of a cruelty to animals situation. Autopsies. Many states, I believe Maryland as well, may indeed say that if the family has a religious reason to oppose autopsies, they won't do it. But under Smith, there is absolutely no requirement that a state give a religious exemption for an autopsy statute. If the statute says anybody who dies of suspicious causes or unknown causes, the body shall be autopsied, you do not have, under Smith, a constitutional right to say this is violating my free exercise rights. And indeed, there are some cases already where after Smith, district courts have indeed said there is no constitutional protection to be free for an autopsy, as long as it's not discriminatory against Jews. Time of death is a major issue. We know that, well, again, the halachic definition is a matter of great controversy. When you have people who are on respirators who are not capable of respiration, the brain stem has been destroyed, but oxygen is being provided through a ventilator, and as a result, the heart keeps beating. Now, generally speaking, in order to do heart transplants, you have to remove the heart, the organ, from a donor while the heart is still beating. Because once the heart stops beating, there is tissue degeneration, and the heart is not suitable for a transplant. The heart is not suitable for a transplant. Now the question is this. According to halacha, is a person dead when the brain is destroyed? If the person is dead, then perhaps the heart transplant would be permitted because you're trying to save another life. But many opinions take the position that a person is halachically alive as long as the heart is beating. And therefore, removal of the heart, even from a brain-dead patient, would be murder against halacha. What the halacha is a matter of dispute, but suffice it to say, there are many, many eminent poskim, if not all, that say as long as the heart is beating, that person is halachically alive. Now, by contrast, in the 50 states of the United States, and this is universal, the definition of death is more or less defined, similar to the Harvard criteria that talk about destruction of the brain stem. Now, most doctors will respect the religious wishes of the patients. In the state of New York, there is in fact a law that says religious accommodations must be respected. But you have to understand, these are no longer backed by constitutional guarantees. If a state were to pass a law that says all people who are dead, their organs must be available for transplantation, and our definition of death is brainstem death, which indeed is the definition, after a case like Smith, there is no free exercise claim to say, gee, that is a violation of my free exercise rights. Theoretically, the prohibitions against serving alcohol to minors. You might have a knock at your door Friday nights, and as you're giving your 10-year-old some wine for Kiddush, you are in violation of state law. Now, it's true that many states do make an exception for sacramental wine, but it's no longer constitutionally required. If you're in Utah or if you're in some fundamentalist state that is a temperance state, there is no longer any constitutional right for exemption. So the Smith case wreaked a tremendous havoc among the Jewish community, particularly the Orthodox Jewish community. And really, what's so interesting is it's such a gratuitously broad decision. There was no particular reason at all to abandon the compelling state interest test. They could have decided the same result by simply saying drug abuse is a compelling state interest, but they didn't, and as a result, we have this problem. Well, shortly after Smith, organizations like Aguda and the Orthodox Union, together with the help of the unfortunately not re-elected Stephen Solars of New York, worked very hard to pass a law that is called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that essentially would provide, not as a matter of constitutional law, because it's not the Constitution, but as a matter of federal law, that no law that affects religious observance shall be applied in contradiction to a religious observance claim unless there's a compelling state interest to do so. In other words, essentially, it would be a statutory codification of what the constitutional law was prior to Smith. The law was approved by the House Judiciary Committee, and it does have, it was backed by over 200 members of Congress, so there are a lot of people who are in favor of the vote. Ironically, the Catholic abortion lobby, is against the law because they're afraid that somehow this would restrict anti-abortion law because pro-choicers would say their religion requires an abortion. So, ironically, they're against that particular law. At the end of the 102nd Congress, which lapsed in December 1992, the law died because it didn't reach the floor. People are trying to reintroduce it now. It has not been reintroduced yet. The Clinton administration has indicated that it's more or less in favor of the law. But, you know, Clinton can change his mind any day on anything. So the religious groups are working very hard. And it is a very, very important piece of legislation, and it might be something for people to get involved in. Again, going back to my earlier point, although we would not be, you know, we should not perhaps be in favor of pushing an agenda that restricts freedoms, even though it incorporates Torah values, but when you're dealing with pushing laws that enlarge freedoms, that is certainly within our best interest. Let me just end with one other recent foray into church-state matters, which raises much more halachic concerns than legal concerns, and I'll share them with you. And this is the recent activity regarding Gittin in the state of New York. And if any of you get New York Magazine, not even New Yorker, New York Magazine, so it's really become a matter of popular culture, you can get the lowdown on the background of this statute. Basically, in response to a personal problem that the daughter of the publisher of the Jewish Press had in getting a get from her husband, Rabbi Klass almost single-handedly, it's really a tribute to the power of the Jewish Press in New York, literally the Jewish Press, managed to get a law passed in the summer of 1992. And this is an amendment to New York State's domestic relations law that says that in determining equitable distribution, right, when a couple gets divorced, a judge decides who gets what property. And in setting maintenance, which we call alimony, in determining how much an alimony recipient will get, the court may consider a whole bunch of factors. It's a whole potpourri of 13 or 14 factors. And one of the factors a judge may now take into account is the maintenance of a barrier to remarriage. Now, you may not know what that means when you first read the words, but it's very clear what it means is the following. That if the husband is a bad guy and doesn't give his wife a get, and as a result, she has a barrier to her remarriage, even after a civil divorce, she cannot get married, right? This is the, what we call the aguna problem. The problem of the fact that even if a woman gets divorced, she cannot marry unless her husband gives her a get. The Beis Din cannot dissolve a marriage. You need the husband to give the get. How do you force the husband to do it? So New York has created an indirect mechanism where essentially a judge looks at the husband and says, listen, I can't force you to give a get, and indeed for a judge to order a husband to give a get would be a violation of separation of church and state. However, you're a bad guy because you're maintaining a barrier to the remarriage of your spouse. Therefore, if you give the get, you'll get 50% of the marital property. If you don't give a get, you'll get zero. Or 10%, or whatever. That is a factor that a court may consider. Same thing with alimony. A judge may tell a man, assuming the man is paying the woman, it doesn't have to be that way, but assuming that's the case, for every week you don't give your wife a get, your alimony is $500 a week. From the time you give a get, it'll drop down to $250. And the theory goes that people don't like to pay money, particularly if it goes to the spouse that they don't like, and therefore that will indirectly induce people to give get. And indeed, this was actually done in Rabbi Klass's daughter's case, even before the statute, where Justice William Rigler of the New York Supreme Court, by the way, in New York is the lowest court, not the highest court, ruled that no equitable distribution until a get is forthcoming. Now, that's fine. Now, that's on its face, from a purely legal perspective, a statute like this makes a lot of sense. Now, some have argued the statute is unconstitutional because a get is a religious ceremony, and you're having a judge tell a person, I mean, what if a judge would tell a person, if you don't daven, you know, if you don't say Shema tomorrow, you're not getting marital assets. Obviously, a secular court cannot force people to engage in religious ceremonies, so some, the American Jewish Congress, for example, has taken the position, this is unconstitutional. You're compelling people to engage in religious observances. The counter-argument is, a get is not a religious observance, because a get is simply a mechanism to dissolve a marital bond. When you give a get, you're not professing a belief in God, you're not expressing, you're not being told to keep Shabbos or keep Kashrus, you are simply told to rescind a contract a certain way. And since you formed a contract through Jewish law, the dissolution must be through Jewish law. But that's a constitutional problem. But here, let me tell you how this is a fascinating instance of where you start passing laws without halakhic input, you can be in a lot of trouble from a halakhic perspective. There is a principle in Jewish law that says that a get must be given with the unfettered free will of the husband. The husband cannot be coerced into giving a get. Now, there are exceptions. The Gemara tells us there are certain instances where a man can be physically forced to give a get. When there's a beis din, that would mean he could be beaten up. Literally, he could be beaten. It says, kofen oso, we beat him, ad shiyom marotzon, until he says he wants. In other words, he has to want, but he can be beaten up till he says he wants. The Rambam raises the question, what type of joke is this? If a get must be given as a matter of free will, so what do you mean you beat him up till he says he wants? How is that free will? So the Rambam explains the following. The Rambam says, well, you know, every Jew in the deep recesses of their soul wants to keep the mitzvahs. That's what you want to do. You want to keep the mitzvahs. But what? But the Yetzer Hara, as it were, distracts you from your mission. You're holding out for money. Why do husbands not give gittin? Sometimes for money. You hold out for custody. But that's not really what you want to do. It's the Yetzer Hara. So when we beat you, what we do is we make the option of non-observance less attractive. It no longer becomes attractive, and what emerges is true will. When you say yes, that's what you want to do. Oh. But keep in mind the following. The Rambam's analysis works only under the specific situations where halacha says you must give your wife a get. And these are very specific situations. They may involve abuse, certainly physical abuse. They may involve a refusal to cohabitate. They may involve even emotional abuse, etc. But if there's simply a situation that under a typical no-fault dissolution statute where it's simply a question of irreconcilable differences or I don't love him anymore, as deplorable as that situation is, and if counseling doesn't work, we would certainly encourage the parties to get a divorce. I mean, if worse comes to worse. But under halacha, not every case of dissatisfaction can result in compulsion. Now, since the Rambam's theory is compulsion only works where it's the person's desire to obey the law of the Torah, where the law of the Torah doesn't say you have to divorce, the get will be invalid as a product of compulsion. Now, what is compulsion? Compulsion can, of course, mean bodily injury, threat of bodily injury. But the poskim say that monetary sanctions, telling a person, if you don't give a get to your wife, I'll take away your money, can also be considered to be a form of compulsion. Now, let's look at the New York statute. The New York statute does not say that a woman, or by the way, a man could be entitled to this as well if a woman refuses to receive a get. So it does go both ways, but usually the problem is the man not giving to the woman. The statute does not say if a beis din has ordered that halakhic grounds for divorce exists, a court may then take that into account. That would be appropriate, because at that point, the court is using compulsion to force a person to comply with the order of a beis din. But the statute doesn't say that, and indeed, constitutionally, the statute probably could not say that, because to say that the court has to look at what a beis din does, in itself raises some serious church-state problems. As far as the statute is concerned, a court could order a husband who is under no obligation to give a get at all, that if you don't give a get, you're losing 50% of your marital property rights. So the question is, the get that the husband then gives may in fact be an invalid get. Now, to produce gittin that are halakhically invalid does not really help a woman very much, because if she's still married and she gets married to somebody else, that's adulterous, and the kids will be mamzerim and the like. So the irony is that a well-intentioned statute may actually backfire because it may produce halakhically invalid gittin. Now, whether it does or not is a matter of dispute. The very two great Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael, many consider the Gedolim of Psak Halacha after the death of Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Eliashiv and Rav Orbach, have paskins that this statute must be repealed. It will produce invalid gittin. There are rabbis in the state of New York who say no Jew in New York can write a get anymore, because every Jew who's writing the get knows if I don't write a get, I can be subject to the compulsion of this statute. Some have said, you can't write a get in the state of New York. And that's not going to raise the shalom bias level either. I mean, people want to get divorced, but they're not going to be able to write a get. So it's an amazing predicament. Now, the Jewish press argues every week that the statute is very good, and he produces letters from rabbinical organizations that he himself has written. If you'll notice, he published three letters, one from the RCA and one from Igor Arban. The wording was identical, so obviously he wrote the letters, although I believe that they signed them. So it's a matter of tremendous, tremendous controversy. And I think the point that we can take out of this, the halakhic problems are very, very complicated, but I think the point that we have to take out of this is that when you pass a law that is touching on fundamental Jewish interests, you can't do it as an individual or as an individual organization. There has to be consensus. There has to be some broad-based agreement among the Hasidic world and the yeshiva world and the modern Orthodox world. People have to get together. You can't have a situation where some rabbis are going to give gittin under this law, which they will, and other rabbis say the get is invalid and the kids are mamzerim. And we're going to have situations where literally different segments of the Torah observant community will not be able to marry. So this is not the type of law that you can do single-handedly. There has to be a broad-based consensus. Are we capable of achieving that broad-based consensus? Probably not. I mean, the state of divisiveness among the religious communities is so great that it's very hard to get people together to decide on anything. But perhaps if we limit our discussion to issues such as gittin and the like, perhaps with that narrow focus, we could achieve it. Let me just end with this. Back in 83, New York did pass another get law, which is still on the books, which in fact was achieved through a very broad-based consensus, and that's a law that says that if you're a divorce plaintiff, if a husband, for example, is filing for divorce against his wife, he cannot get a civil divorce unless he removes his wife's remarriage barrier. And that actually is halakhically very good, because there you see the only punishment the husband is getting for not giving a get is he doesn't get a civil divorce. That's a denial of a benefit. That's not giving him something. Not giving him something is not halakhically the same as taking something away. So there, before that statute was passed, there was coordination between Agoda and the Orthodox Union, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Schwab, Rav Moshe Stern, many, the Satmar Dayanim, many Hasidic leaders as well. And that really should have been the model that would be followed for a statute like this. Right now, besides the Chilul Hashem of having a lot of dirty linen exposed in New York Magazine and the weekly diatribes of the Jewish press, we have actually a very halakhically problematical issue. So the issue of separation of church-state is not only a matter of constitutional law, but it also impacts on halakhic concerns as well. So you need both very capable lawyers and very great poskim who have to work together to be able to determine which way these issues should go. Thank you. I guess I'll take some questions.
Yes, how wonderfully, what was the thought from the person that we're asking?
Well, different posts can give different answers. I did not hear any definitive psak regarding Maryland per se. Agudas Israel generally has, in various briefs, etc., with the Supreme Court, upon advice of their leadership, has tended towards a pro-life position. They have believed that although abortion is technically not murder, but because it does involve the taking away of potential life, we do have to take an interventionist stance. With respect to gay rights, Agudas' concern has always been, and I think the National Union is somewhat similar, the Orthodox Union is somewhat similar, has been that we're not in favor of discrimination against gays, but we have to be sure that we don't have to accept them in the forums which expose our children, etc. So, in effect, they're very worried with the anti-discrimination ordinances, not because they're against them in principle, but they're against the application of how this would play out.
Therefore, they were against them.
By and large, I think they're against them, yeah. And I understand this. If you consider, for example, New York City's curriculum where you introduce first graders, you can see their point.
Number one, with regard to the abortion issue, does it become a problem with the use of public funds, and is it a problem with perhaps withholding funds because of that? And if perhaps a second issue, if you could touch upon, always disturbed me what the points of the Supreme Court were in two particular cases. One where they ruled that a nativity scene is not a religious observance and therefore permissible for a county government to put it up. And secondly, the issue of, I believe it was an officer in the military wearing tzitzit or a kippah became a problem. And what were the arguments that the Supreme Court
answering your first question first, I do think a very principled distinction could be drawn between permitting choice and not requiring government to pay for that choice. There are many choices in which the government does not have to get involved in, and I think this is a very good candidate. Because the pro-choice position that I'm suggesting does not rest on any inherent right of choice, but rather a freedom from government intervention, and that would argue against public funding. Now, in terms of your two Supreme Court issues, you're referring to the Allegheny County case in Pittsburgh. Now, that's a tremendous mess of a case, because this was a case in Pittsburgh that involved a menorah and a nativity scene in a county courthouse, and the court was split two ways, three ways, really. There was 4-4 with one swing vote. One group of four wanted to ban both. One group of four wanted to uphold both. And one vote made a difference. So essentially, you don't have any majority opinion at all. But the theory of the majority of the five who were in favor of allowing the nativity scene was, since you have the menorah there as well, therefore, taken into a context, it represents all religions.
Now, I thought there was a case in Massachusetts where they...
Maybe thinking about a different case.
...that a nativity scene is not a religious observance, and therefore the county can pay for it.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that case, but I'll tell you what the theory of the court is leaning to. The theory of the court is leaning towards saying that as long as there's no coercion, as long as there's no attempt to proselytize, people can do what they want even on public property. Now, that may sound a little disturbing, because on one level, that'll mean you can see Christmas trees and nativity scenes in public, but I should say that there's a silver lining to that cloud, and that is, as the Supreme Court is saying, as long as there's no coercion or proselytization, it's okay for the government to get involved, that could open the door to vouchers and various aids to private schools, which for many years have been off limits because of separation of church and state. So the same theory that upholds the nativity scene can be used to uphold vouchers for yeshiva tuition. So I'm sure the Jewish organizations will be using that weakening of the church-state clause to argue for that. In terms of the military, well, all I can say is the Supreme Court's position has always been that in the military and in prison, those are the two contexts, you basically have very, very few constitutional rights. The need for military discipline overrides everything. It's really in a class by itself. And whether that should be the case is another question, but that has not gone beyond narrow contexts. Yes?
The issue of the nativity scene, how would you relate that to school prayer? It's the same idea. The person doesn't have to pray if it's voluntary school prayer, but the problem is that if everyone else is praying and you're not, you're in class by yourself.
Yeah, well, the Supreme Court addresses that. The Supreme Court basically says, number one, school prayer, you're dealing in a inside a classroom setting where there's coercion, there's embarrassment, especially if it's a younger child, to tell a child to go out into another room or to tell a child you don't have to participate when all of his classmates are doing so is a very, very direct kind of embarrassment, humiliation, coercion, proselytization. There's pressures. The court kind of said, well, if you're outside and you're walking through a park, it's really a question of degree. They said the proselytization is not as great. Whether you buy that is one thing, but they have drawn the line. They have basically, the one thing they're not going to allow is prayer. In fact, there was a case just last summer about graduation prayers in a high school graduation. Jewish parents brought a suit to enjoin it, and they won. That even non-denominational prayers at public school graduations are no longer constitutionally allowed. Okay, well, thank you very much. Yes?
You spoke here about two different kinds of laws. You spoke about abortion laws, which the purpose would be to try and impose Noahide law or Jewish perception of Noahide law on the world. And then you spoke about something like the Get law, which is something that we're using to preserve our own society to be able to function within Halakha.
Right.
Is it contradictory for us to be lobbying and trying to bring through laws such as the Get law, but lying silent on something which is supposed to affect our society?
Well, to some extent, the same dangers you have with the first category, you do have with the second category, because you're using legislative processes, but I think the dangers are much less pronounced. When you're trying to impose something on non-believers, your allies will tend to be Christian fundamentalists and the like, and they could very well turn around and impose restrictions on us, Sunday closing laws or whatever. When you're dealing with things that have a much more limited application to the Jewish community per se, there we're not really hurting anybody else, and therefore the backlash issue and the issue of it coming back to haunt us, I think, is less pronounced. For example, if you take kashrus laws, Maryland has a law regarding fraudulent labeling of kosher food. The Supreme Court recently, by the way, struck down New Jersey's somewhat similar law. People say Maryland's law is different. But there too, you're simply dealing with the disclosure statute. If I sell you a camera, I have to disclose, the various components of the camera. So that's just kind of a neutral situation to protect a consumer. That's not really imposing an agenda of any moral vision on anybody else. So I think there are different situations where legislative intervention is warranted and some in which it's not. Yes?
You alluded to something in the beginning of the talk, which you probably didn't want to talk about, but maybe you could comment, and that is separation of church and state in Israel.
Yeah. It's very, very difficult because, in the Torah's description of a Jewish society, there is no separation of church and state. Well, in one realm there is, because we have the Melech, the king, and we have the Kohen. And there is a special halacha that a Kohen is not allowed to be a Melech. The Ramban says in Chumash, the whole problem of the Chashmonaim was that there were Kohanim who became kings. So you do see there is a notion of separation of church and state institutionally, that the political leader of a government should not be a religious leader. And I think that itself is an interesting point. But in terms of governing law, the Torah clearly envisions that the law of the Jewish state should be the law of the Torah. However, again, that does not seem to apply in a circumstance where the vast majority of Jews are not Torah observant. Because when you have a lack of a prophet, and the lack of a Beis HaMikdash, the lack of a Mashiach, then generally speaking, the only way people are brought to Torah and faith in God is by non-coercive tools. Coercion can work when you have a society where the majority of that society is committed to a norm, and you have deviance. When you have deviance, first of all, how great does our prison system work? But if you have deviance, you can deal with coercion. But in the current state of affairs, you can't have coercive methods when the vast majority of your society is not committed to your norms. Look at apartheid in South Africa, for example, where you have a majority of society
that does not accept that norm, coercion is not going to help. So I'm very much against, again, it's my opinion, many people disagree with me, and you know, I don't state that it's right. I am tremendously against religious parties being involved in the government of the State of Israel. If there would be no religious parties at all, then religion would be something that every single party would have to reckon with. Every single party would have to take into account the sensibilities of a religious segment of the population, and people could concentrate on, you know, the problems that Israel faces in terms of economy and everything else. Now, religion just becomes another special interest group, and I think that hurts the Kiruv movement very, very much among Israelis, at least. So, what's complicated is, the Torah does not envision a true separation of church and state, but the Torah also envisions a society where the majority is committed to the norm. And where you don't have that situation, I don't see how religion can be politicized in that manner. Okay, any questions? Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Rabbi Breidowitz for that stimulating discussion, at least as stimulating as bankruptcy law. Benching this evening will be led by Rabbi Israel Drazen.
I guess the argument is that that when it's dissolved, exactly, it's going to be a dissolution of the society. In other words, how do you monitor marriage? I mean, how do you monitor marriage?
How do you monitor marriage?
I'm
certain percentage of every thousand.
I'm